Okay, good morning and welcome to the Pain Science Division's Paincast. This is the June edition. And today we're going to be speaking with Gerald Yardley and Jake Tumber. I'm Lisa Carlesso, and I'm a Pain Science Division member and hosting this session for today. And I'm just going to ask Daryl and Jake to start out by introducing themselves. So, Daryl, do you want to give a bit of background to our members?
Sure. Well, thanks, Lisa, to you and the Pain Science Division for inviting me to speak today. So my background, I've been a physio in private practice since 2006. I was able to complete my Minute Fellowship in 2008. And currently, right now, I'm the chair of the private practice division, as well as I have two teaching positions at Western and the University of Toronto, where I focus primarily on the business and practice management themes within the PT curriculums.
Great. And Jake?
My name's Jake Tumber. I'm a physio and clinic manager of Reinhold Rehab in Hamilton. Been a physio 5 years and a PSD member for 3 years. And I'm also currently the associate clinical editor of the PSD newsletter.
Oh, excellent. All right. So I guess what I just omitted to say at the beginning was what we're going to be discussing today. We're talking to Daryl and Jake about a pilot project that they've launched in trying to identify or screen for people who are having poor outcomes, primarily in the motor vehicle whiplash population, and then looking at subsequent treatment for those people. So before we launch into the project details, I'm wondering if both of you could perhaps also give a bit of background for how you each developed interest in pain science. So, Gerald, do you want to start?
Sure, thanks, Lisa. So I think for me, where my interest started was just looking at my, doing a self-reflection of my practice and realizing there was truly a missing link between, my typical caseload and some of the what I would consider in the past is my atypical caseload just didn't have the same outcomes with the typical treatments I was providing, and then even that sort of would always precipitate more self-directed lifelong learning, and it's still hitting a barrier with some of those patients. So the other, the other nice thing with me being connected to some of the universities and through the educational systems was just meeting a lot of intellectual or intelligent colleagues along the way. So I've had the fortunate ability to work with Jeff Bostick as well as Dave Walton at Western. So it's actually helped open my eyes to what sort of cutting edge research and practice changing research exists out there, which has obviously had a big impact on my practice. And then obviously having the opportunity to work with colleagues like Jake in the province has been quite helpful. But I think the one other key piece for me is that I've had a much greater focus on looking at it from more of the patient relationship, the therapeutic alliance side of things, and realizing that when you really start to hone in on that psychosocial side of the actual therapeutic outcome or intervention, that's where a big sort of focused on education around pain and reducing threat of pain and really started to change where my practice was going. However, my other little sort of sticking point was just the delivery of that educational aspect of pain on the patients, which is sort of what led me into my little pilot project with Jake.
Great. Yeah, I'm sure many of our members share the same kind of sentiment and have similar barriers. So, okay, Jake, and how about you?
Yeah, so I think after my first year as a PT, I was quite intrigued as to why certain patient groups simply wouldn't respond to our usual treatment modalities. And so that began my headlong investigation into the effects of manual therapy, the therapeutic alliance, the nervous system, the brain, and also the way some third-party funders treat or word about pain. WSOB, the MVA sector. So I began to look into the evidence and took some courses, and that began my sort of full-blown interest in pain science and education. Currently, my caseload is over 50% MVA, and as we know, these can be challenging. So, in the last 2 years, I've been trying to focus on the education piece, the self-management piece, trying to get these people moving forward in this very difficult time for them, particularly with the auto insurance.
Right. Great. Okay. So why don't we we'll jump right in and have you guys discuss the project, because I'm sure that's what people are interested to hear about. So Daryl, can you just talk a little bit about how this initially, the project came about and its initial design and go from there?
Sure. Sure. Thanks. So how the project came about is we sort of looked at Jake's practice and we tried to divvy up to what is the, you know, the typical private practice physio setting these days versus what is the you know, more of the atypical. And I kind of look at Jake's practice as one of the atypical, and instead of calling it a specialized practice, which I think it will, you know, as he sort of completes the specialization aspect through CPA, that is when we would sort of coin that term. So right now is to ensure that the clinics across, so I oversee a network of 15 clinics, and it's hard to get some of the physios to switch outside of that typical practice setting. So we're trying to identify it as an atypical population that we've kind of used a and created a process to say, okay, at 6 weeks, we want to see where our outcomes are. Are these patients recovering at an appropriate recovery rate that we would expect based on the type of injury, their timeline post-injury, and looking at what are obviously using a little bit more of an ICF model, what are their, you know, their activity limitations and their function and their participation restrictions, as opposed to just being very, very impairment focused. Mm-hmm. So at that, from that perspective, what we're looking at is we're just using, and we kind of left up to the physios. So we did choose one clinic specifically that had a past history of managing MVA patients and looking at it from a perspective of a lot more education and pain science. And obviously that clinic had a larger pool of MBA patients that we could select from. But we allowed the individual to choose sort of what pain measure she would be looking at, whether it was a PCS or a fear avoidance questionnaire. Mm-hmm. From that perspective, once we identified that patient, we sort of had done a touch base with Jake to say, do you feel that this would be an appropriate candidate? It was a quick sort of yes. And then the next phase of that was, okay, well, now we need to request funding. And the unfortunate part so far, even in the project, it'd be nice if it was just a very simplistic, let's request the funding. But oftentimes it required a lot of extra education resources and tools to go into sort of, let's just for example, an OCF 18 to ensure that the insurer on the other end, the decision maker, was going to approve the funding for this individual mm-hmm. patient. And then once we were to receive funding, now the next part of scheduling and ensuring that time's available for the meets Jake schedule as a contractor, and then obviously meets within our the availability of the patient, which has always been a challenge. And then once we can actually get the patient in clinic to meet with Jake, that's when we start off with some pre and post educational seminar measures. And then obviously we're going to now start to add as well a patient satisfaction tool, because the more that we can pull together in order to give to the insurance company is going to help us hopefully from an advocacy perspective in ensuring that we can achieve or receive funding for this very critical part of recovery for patients, especially when they're still having some high pain scores at a 6 week timeline. I kind of feel that kind of moves them from that, let's just, you know, call it a fast responder to a slow responder result to outcome. And I just don't like all of a sudden a patient gets deemed, oh, they have chronic pain because they are not responding to typical treatment. I think, sure, the symptoms at some point will get to that chronic duration, but I feel that it just requires a different subset of treatment potentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. If you can identify those people and get them kind of fast-tracking more. And so just to a point of clarification, is there any screening? You mentioned the PCS and the fear avoidance. Were they initially used at the assessment as well, or just at the 6 week point?
when we originally rolled it out, we just started at the 6-week point. Okay. It's now being brought into, or the hope is that on our follow-up after our first pilot with the, or sorry, with the first two, three patients that went through,
yeah.
It's now going to be put into the original intake to okay. be redone again at 6 weeks.
Right, great. Yeah. Okay. Okay, and so Jake, can you speak to the actual kind of implementation and treatment side of things and how that's all working?
Yeah, so this is just to give a little bit of background. This was pain science education was always provided by the current clinic I'm at, and I simply took it over a couple of years ago. Pain science education has become kind of a bit of a buzz phrase in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why I spoke with Daryl about trying to get this going with other clinics. Originally, the intervention was two-hour sessions of sort of the explain pain piece and then the treat pain piece.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that logistically that was getting a little bit tricky to organize patients. So I managed to sort of condense it down to a three-hour one-off intervention. So that was how we've sort of decided to keep it rolling, purely because of logistics, space, and timing of that intervention. And the three-hour is essentially still broken down to the sort of the explain pain piece for these patients and then generalized guidelines on treatment, including self-management, knowledge, the meditation piece, the things that we now know that we have to tell these patients.
Mm-hmm.
And what I try to do is hopefully we'll get some more PCS scores coming in prior to me starting. But I would usually fill out a neurophysiology of pain questionnaire for the patients. The patient would fill them out so I can see before and after if there's been any change. So that's the revised edition, the 13-point questionnaire.
Mm-hmm.
Then I can see if the intervention is effective, whether I've actually taken home some of these points.
Great.
Yeah.
And so can you speak a little bit more about some of the actual content, like for instance, the meditation piece or any other piece and how that, do you actually teach them how to meditate, for example, or how do you go about doing that?
Yeah. So what I do is I try to keep it, I do go through a normal, like a guided breathing, piece, something usually very simple. As soon as I start saying meditation, people start kind of drifting off somewhere else.
Right.
So often I talk about the breathing piece and give not only an example, but some simple research, like a simple outline of research, giving the intervention about why this is a useful thing to do. And then I'll also give them some resources to go to, smartphone apps, YouTube, CDs. Even there's plenty on the web now that's free. People don't really know how to access this stuff. So
mm-hmm.
I give lots of resources about how they can access this. I'm no expert at meditation or mindfulness, but there's plenty of people who are, and I send them out to those resources.
Great.
And Hamilton, because I'm mainly working in Hamilton, there are some community access points as well for that kind of thing. There's free meditation classes. So I'll often provide those resources for them.
Mm-hmm. And that's a great tip for people to be aware of is certainly, the web has always got a wealth of information, but to look within your own community and see what kind of things might be offered so that people can actually physically go and have some human interaction and be instructed is always a good thing. Okay, and what about, I'm just wondering if you can maybe say a little bit more too about in terms of the pain education piece,
mm-hmm.
Some of the languaging and way that you deliver that. I know there's been a lot of focus on on how we say things and, and how we address things. So
this has been a very this has evolved over time, and really looking at how presentations work and reading Adrian Lowe's recent book, The Therapeutic Neuroscience Education, as well as how some of the great educators do it, I certainly have evolved to include more videos, more pictures, and less lengthy wording, to almost the painful yarns approach by Mosley. So people can actually take this on board in layman's terms, because a lot of the feedback I originally got was, Jake, this is too complicated, we can't understand this stuff. So there's lots of videos that help explain big concepts, neurophysiological concepts, central sensitization concepts, that you can really break down patients' sort of understanding. And even simple things like the relationship between pain and tissue damage take some time to explain sometimes. So the more images and stories I have that explain this, the more on board I have the patients become.
Yeah, I can imagine when you've got, you know, people sitting in front of you with pain and you're just talking at them, right? That they, as you said, when you were talking about the meditation piece, it, that you can lose them quite easily. And so the more that you can kind of keep them stimulated and have an interactive environment would be helpful. Okay, and so can you tell us a little bit about preliminary results that you're seeing?
Yes, so our first, so we're still very early days, Lisa. We had, unfortunately, one class had to be cancelled, but in our, I ran a class for a patient a couple of weeks ago. Neurophysiology of pain questionnaire had a 30% improvement, which was great, and we actually had I had an email from the physio and who said the patient had come in and to the clinic without an appointment and said how much she enjoyed the class and how she found it useful. So initial feedback was good, even though it's not kind of official. We'll try to make it official in the future, get some sort of more outcome measures added. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's exciting that the patient was excited, you know, and found that helpful. That's always a good indication. So,
Lisa, can I add just one couple
of
things?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think the one thing, too, from that is, you know, especially in the private practice world, is sort of this underwritten value placed on what patients value, too, coming through the clinic. So I think there's this part where, as, you know, as therapists in our typical settings, we work so hard to sort of deliver this high quality treatment for patients is kind of what we perceive at times. And I think this is where this shift is happening too, with really truly going down the patient-centered model, where we actually have this patient, you know, really starting to see, okay, what is it that you value? What is it that you need? And having somebody come back to literally, you know, with no appointment, to come back and say how beneficial that was. It speaks volumes with how critical a program like this is actually needed. Now, like, after listening to Jake talk, and I know we've talked about this on many, many occasions, but it would be interesting, because I think one of the pieces that's missing is, just like when we go to entry level practice, is we all get, you know, basic content, we get basic knowledge, we evolve as, you know, we grow our practices and our skill sets as we grow through our professional careers. But I really still think that once we get that basic knowledge and understanding of pain science, and then we want to integrate it into our practice, I think that's critical. But I think there's still going to be this cohort of patients that requires a higher level of knowledge and sort of patience in that side of the sort of science world. And I think, too, that's where the delivery comes down, because I'm curious to say, if we were to now do a comparative study on that, to say that we just gave somebody the presentation that Jake did, relative to Jake giving the presentation, I'm curious to know if whether the patient would perceive the same value.
Yeah, well, you know, that's an interesting comment. I think there's several things that could impact that, but you know, even like, for instance, the patient's familiarity with Jake or not, and feeling comfortable, and certainly just each individual, like each PT's kind of ability to effectively communicate and interact. You know, there's a lot of kind of interpersonal things that could impact on that. So that would certainly be something interesting to look at down the road. But, you know, Daryl, when you're talking about kind of patient-centered care, and earlier on when you were saying that you use the ICF model, I think, you know, that's a great thing that you've done there. And you know, we all talk about, you know, we talk a lot about patient-centered care and about the biopsychosocial framework, but to see that it's actually, you know, being implemented and considered is great. And sometimes I think, you know, we talk a lot about these things, but we don't actually follow through so much. So I think that's excellent that you guys have actually put that into action. Okay, so I think what we'd like to do is maybe just have both of you talk a little bit about what you see as the future directions of this program and where you see it going and the potential for it, really. So, Daryl, do you want to start?
Sure. So I think one of the big things that we'd like to do as well is start to create at least a program that, even from this seminar, that individual clinics and individual clinicians, or obviously at some point it would be partnered clinicians, can take away. And we can start to transfer this across the province, especially since we're talking about the quasi-public funder, you know, funders right now of the MBA world. However, it would be good that hopefully this will also provide some insight. So as we go across the different jurisdictions and where some of the legislation is a little bit differently in the motor vehicle industry, is that at least there's some pieces that potentially that will require a little bit more out-of-the-box thinking based specifically on your particular province. But hopefully it's something that can be transferable across the country. And I think too, when we look at, you know, physiotherapy outcomes and where we have sort of what I call many, many untapped resources to the big decision makers in the healthcare system, just gives us a chance to improve outcomes of chronic pain patients in the private practice setting. So less patients falling through the cracks and more sort of opportunity to ensure they're seeing the right people. And I think that sort of leads me into the focus of we do a lot of talk around interprofessional collaboration, and I think it's done extremely well in the public sector. And I think this is an area of huge opportunity in the private sector. So that way we stop sort of looking at, we're going to remove sort of the professional silos. So very little communication and I have a typical treatment that I'm going to apply and that's going to help you, or that didn't work. So then you're going to go see a different physio, could be a different provider. And then that didn't work, but there's never really been a synergistic relationship. So I think this is an opportunity to really try to encourage that atypical population that doesn't respond to our sort of forte of treatment, let's say, it starts to create a little bit more collaboration and coordination of care. Mm-hmm. And I think that's truly where we start to get more sort of ammunition into the mix to say, look at these outcomes, because that when you have more, you know, brains into one case or more eyes and ears from an active listening perspective into a case, I truly believe that's where our outcomes, and that's where a lot of research is going these days to support that. But I think to take it to a little bit of a higher level though, is this is actually one of those things where we need to show that our profession's advancing with the cutting edge research that's coming out. And I think there's a lot more reliance these days or at least input from patients and what their experiences and what they perceive they are looking for as well is coming into play. So, you know, as you know, even as the baby boomers go, there's expectations for their care that's become greater. And same thing for our generations going through, our expectations are a little bit higher with what type of care we receive. But I think the reality is the health systems are changing as well. And I think this is where we need to evolve a little bit more within sort of this in the health disciplines to look at saying, you know, identifying patients earlier and getting them to the right person at the right place at the right time.
Right. Yeah. Lots of things interacting there. So, okay. And Jake, what about you? What do you see as the future direction from your side of where you're working in the program?
Yeah. So I think I'd really like to get get the outcome measure tracking down so we can really support this intervention. And I don't think it's anything that we've done wrong necessarily up to now. It's just a question of logistics and timing. So I think if we have PCS, Fab Qs, even some psych measures as well, I think that would really help us out to figure out the timing of this intervention. Because what's key is now, what stage do we do this education piece? When do we do this intervention? Right. In the MVA sector, when we talk about MIG versus someone who's, you know, non-MIG, would it be worth taking some of that 3,500 and saying, well, you know what, because of your high pain scores, your high NDIs, your high PCS, this is worth putting the money towards versus whatever, something else. Right. Either on the goods and services or at that end stage of the 12 weeks, when would be the most beneficial time to do this intervention for this patient? Because we know when they're done the MIG, getting them out of the MIG is extremely hard.
Yeah. Sorry, Jake, can you just tell our listeners, for people outside of Ontario, what a MIG is?
Oh, beg your pardon. A MIG is the a minor injury guideline,
okay.
Which is anything that's deemed soft tissue injury only, be that WAD 1, WAD 2, sprains, strains, contusions, non-fractures. Fractures would be out of a MIG, but it's a 3,500 limit on the funding, and the goal is for sort of a functional restoration approach, and essentially that's, and you're given a certain amount of time over 12 weeks to provide treatment and education and home exercise, and then it slowly weans off the number of times you can see the patient.
Right.
And it's done in blocks of treatment. So 4-week block and then another 4-week block, and you slowly wean off the patient.
Okay.
So I think there is some extra funding. At the end of the 12 weeks, there's a little bit of extra funding available sometimes. And one of our things going forward is, would it be worth providing this intervention for those people so that they have the tools to move forward, progress, and self-manage without seeing a physiotherapist regularly?
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of on an OCF-18, so people if they aren't in a MIG and they have access to higher levels of funding, which is 50,000 to 100,000, depending on how much insurance they've purchased.
Right.
The intervention is not usually there's an approval on that a little bit easier because there's more money available, but still we provide to the adjuster, the insurance company, what outcome measures we're looking at, what intervention we're doing, and what are the references that support this intervention. So this isn't just, oh, we're going to teach these guys about pain. We're going to teach them this stuff specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the reasons why.
Right.
Because there's lots of good evidence now that supports this.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a good piece of information, again, for our membership, just to know that, yeah, you're not just saying, oh, yeah, we're going to do pain science because we know it works. You're actually giving them some outcome measures with the support of how they are implemented and what they tell us, and then references to support the education piece. So, and certainly, you know, from a funder's point of view, that's the kind of information that they want and need to see in order to justify, right? So,
yeah, and I think we've done that each and every time. And with the physio that I've been working with at Daryl's clinic, I've given her that information, and it's so far we've been approved. So I think that's nice for them to see that. This isn't, you know, something that we just have chosen at this particular time for a random reason. It's for specific reasons.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, I think this is fantastic what you guys are doing. Hopefully it can, you know, give some other members some ideas around things that they can do, start doing within their own private setting. But I'm wondering if both of you can maybe think about, just some tips, I guess, for people who are wanting to start down this path, not necessarily immediately developing a huge program, but what are some things that kind of your average practitioner could be doing that even if it's specific to this particular population or not, that could help, in terms of screening, identifying people and treating them. So, Gerald, do you want to?
Sure. I think the first tip I'd have, though, is try to create sort of that pathway of care, if you don't mind using that term. Try to figure out, so what happens when my workflow of the day, what happens when my patient first comes into the clinic, for assessment, developing your treatment plan, and how you evaluate that treatment plan. But I think the critical step in that comes to, as what we've identified today, is just timely outcome measure implementation. And then determining, too, is what is your criteria to maybe go down that specific pathway of care? And I think what I hope to see over time, too, is instead of it being called an atypical population that I treat versus my typical population that I treat, is we start to then create a little bit more about cohorts around, especially that's where you see a lot of the low back pain research these days going about how we should treat this type of patient that presents with this type of pathology or symptoms. And then just breaking it down that way, because I think once people get used to looking at a pathway of care, which we see already, implemented in the total joint network, and now obviously some of the low back pain research, I think it's a critical step is if that's the way the research is going and how it'll be nice to start to communicate with the funders as well. But I think the other aspect of in the private practice sector is I would have loved to have seen this, have 20 patients by the time we started it, but obviously patients, and not the patients we treat, but actually being patient in this process is critical because there is going to have to be a lot of sort of investigation and discovery around what funding avenues do exist for these patients. Because really, by the time we see a lot of these patients now as actually working backwards, they've typically exhausted their funding. So this is now where hopefully with a better pathway of care and workflow analysis and timely outcome measure implementation, just like Jake was saying with the minor injury guideline, hopefully we can have earlier intervention, which would allow us to have, develop or deliver our services and actually have a higher outcome on the other end, which for me from a private sector and then obviously a health systems reform perspective, we start to then justify that we are sort of a profession that can have high outcomes in a realistic timeline of service delivery.
Mm-hmm. Great. And Jake, what about you? What tips do you have?
Tips for the day-to-day. I think within a clinic, you need to maintain some kind of common message about the implementation of this approach. It's great to have one PT doing this as kind of the pain science guy, but the message can quickly become eroded or distorted if they're seeing other members of the team, be it massage, kinesiology, whoever, who provide a contradictory response or explanation for the patient's pain. That doesn't help. That makes things very difficult for the patient and even for the educating PT as well. So a common message is required. Simple educational material in the clinic, there's plenty available now. There's good educational posters. There's very simple, easier to read books out there now that can be left around the clinic. But I certainly think you need a passion for this type of intervention. You need a PT who's going to maintain, because the evidence for this is growing at an exponential rate at the moment. You need someone who's going to keep up with this stuff, keep changing the delivery of the information based on feedback. This isn't simple. The information is not just the key. The delivery is also the key.
Yeah. Well, I think that your point about the unified message is a great one, too. I mean, we've heard about certainly how the kind of negative effects of using a biomedical approach, and again, mm-hmm. talking about, a lot about structures and whatnot. So mm-hmm. I think that's a great point that you've made about making sure that other people on the team, everybody's talking the same language and giving the same message, because just mm-hmm. having one person, you know, kind of undo the work that everyone else is trying to do could really have an impact on the progress. Well, that's great, guys. Thank you so much for that. I know that right before we started, Daryl, you had mentioned about encouraging some feedback. Did you want to just speak to that a bit?
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for having us too, Lisa. Greatly appreciated. But I think too now is, you know, even with sort of the workflow or the pilot project we've created, I think is always, it's just truly in its infancy. So if any individuals have done any other similar types of program across the country or have any ideas of how, you know, Jake and I can actually improve upon this program, I think we're always looking at a nice simplified version and process to for others to implement as well. So we both of us are open to feedback. So I suppose the best way to get a hold of me would be through email. And maybe is it best, Lisa, if I underneath the podcast or be able to just post my email there, or
you can just say it.
Say it now? Sure. So the best way to get a hold of me would be so daryl.yardley@gmail.com. So daryl.yardley@gmail.com.
Great. And the other avenue for our members would be to provide some feedback or discussion points through the our newsletter. Jake, you're the man there to contact. So do you want to talk about just mention how people can go about submitting comments for the newsletter?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. On the website or the newsletter. We're starting to put the newsletter up on the website now. Jordan is the editor, so he would be the main go-to guy, mm-hmm. but certainly he could pass on any feedback to me. I know he'd be interested to hear it as well because he does this. So yeah, Jordan Miller is the editor of the newsletter.
Great. All right. Well, thanks again so much, both of you, for making the time, and we look forward to hearing more about this in the future. Maybe next year we'll check back in and see how things are going and give people an update and let them know about all the great results you guys are generating.
Great. Thanks, Lisa.
I hope all right. So. Thanks a lot, Lisa.
All right. Take care, everyone. Have a great weekend.
You too.
You too. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.